It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at the intersection of motherhood and politics.
First, a new bill in the state legislature would change the way law enforcement handles 911 calls from underage drinkers.
The so-called Good Samaritan bill got a public hearing today. If passed, it would grant immunity from at least some citations to underage drinkers calling in medical emergencies. But not everyone is in support of the bill.
Joining us now is WPR reporter Gilman Halstad, who covered the hearing. Gilman, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me.
So tell us a bit about this Good Samaritan legislation. What would change under the bill?
Well, basically what would change is if you are an underage drinker and a friend of yours passes out and you're really worried that they may die and you call 911, then when the police and ambulance arrive, you would not be charged. You would not be given a ticket, even though you had been drinking. And the victim might also not get a ticket as long as they were cooperative. There was a little bit of confusion about that at the hearing today, is how you would define whether or not the person was cooperating or not. And there seemed to be some indication that if you were passed out, that qualifies as not cooperating. So you could actually be charged as the victim, the one in need of the emergency services, but your friend who called would not be charged. That's the main change. But one of the things that people are concerned about at the university anyway, and some dean of student affairs are concerned about, is that that it also prevents the university from imposing some discipline that they have in the past on underage drinkers.
So this would supersede the university's regulations.
Right. And it would prevent them from using disciplinary measures like kicking somebody out of a dorm after, you know, it could be someone that they've had a problem with for a long time, but then they call them in or suspending them from the university. And they don't think that that's such a great idea because they feel that that's an important tool it's a stick in some ways to have out there, but also a way to keep peace in the dorm and on campus if somebody's really becoming a problem. And one of the deans who testified said he's actually had students come back and thank him for throwing them out of the dorm or off campus because it was a wake-up call for them, and they came back to school and didn't get drunk.
Well, the bill got a public hearing today, and those who spoke in favor of it, why do they think it's needed?
Well, definitely the strongest support comes from students. And the Associated Students of Madison spokesperson there made it clear that there is a lot of fear among students who are breaking the law in this way, that it's going to go on their records and they're going to have to pay this fine or they get kicked off campus, so they don't call when help is needed. And there's been some research done. 17 states already have a law like this, and lots of campuses have this in place, and it has led to an increase in the number of calls that are being made to medical emergency. And the students say, look, it's working, that fear is diminished, but also lots of campuses require, as UW-Madison does, if you get caught in that situation and they want to keep this in the bill, you would have to go through an alcohol intervention program on campus. And if you don't complete that program of educational counseling and learning about the dangers of drinking too much, then you would get the ticket anyway. So the sanction would still be out there.
So it sounds like college officials are a little divided about this.
Yeah.
They're losing some of their, you call them sticks, to you know, get the students to come around and not drink as much or not be a problem when it comes to alcohol consumption. But what about law enforcement? What do they have to say about
They're concerned as well because it puts them in a difficult situation. And there were several scenarios discussed that the supporters of the bill didn't really have clear answers to. I mean, if one student calls and a bunch of students stay around until the police and the ambulance show up, who among them is actually not going to get the ticket? The police has to decide that. I mean, I guess they'll have the phone number, so that would be a possibility. And they just don't like being put in the position of making that kind of a decision. The law does say that if there is not a proven medical emergency, if someone doesn't end up going to the hospital after that, then everybody's going to get a ticket, even though they made the call because they thought there was. There's another gray area in it there about how are the police going to decide whether it really was an emergency or not before they issue the ticket. And those were the main issues that the police raised that they thought needed to be addressed some way in the bill.
So is a ticket the main thing that the police would do right now if they showed up? It sounds like the colleges could do something additional, but the police would just issue a ticket.
Right, and make sure that emergency services were called, right. But the police themselves, they'd be enforcing the current state law on underage drinking.
Well, binge drinking on college campuses has gotten a lot of attention recently. UW-Madison, and not just UW, but the UW system, I gather, often shows up on lists of top party schools.
Right.
Is this putting some pressure, do you think, on the UW system and here in Wisconsin to pass something like this?
Well, I suppose that's part of it. But, I mean, the distinction, the debate seems to be about dealing with medical emergencies, balancing dealing with medical emergencies and dealing with underage drinking. And so the argument is we're going to save lives. Good Samaritan, take care of somebody who might have died otherwise versus try to change the behavior of underage drinkers that the law is not going to change, right? I mean, people are still not allowed to drink and are breaking the law if they're under 21. So I think there is pressure there, but the pushback from the Dean of Student Affairs from UW-River Falls who spoke, I think, is really there, and I think that's shared by a lot of the campuses. They'd like the ability to have those programs in place and have their own university discipline. They don't want the state taking away that part of it.
Now, you mentioned that there were 17 other states, I believe,
right,
that have similar Good Samaritan laws around underage drinking like this. Any data come up today about whether it is effective in saving lives?
Well, one study was referred to that was done at Cornell University, where this has been in place for 2 years. But the key thing is here that they have that program where even though they're not getting the ticket, they're going to have to go through this disciplinary process. And they found that once they had no more fear of getting the fine for underage drinking, that there was a big rise. It was only 22% of students were going through this alcohol and screening intervention program before that, and that went up to 52% after this was implemented. So people were making the calls. They were being disciplined by the college, but they were not getting the legal sanction on their record.
Now, as it stands now, is this just for alcohol or does this include other drugs?
This is just alcohol right now. It focuses specifically on underage drinking. You know, we've had this other law that has been passed, part of this package of laws, Senator Nygren, back to deal with heroin so that people can make these calls to prevent heroin overdoses and not face drug possession charges. So that's a completely separate issue. This is only about drinking.
Gilman, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today. We've been talking to WPR reporter Gilman Halstead. He was at today's hearing on Good Samaritan laws for underage drinkers.
Texas State Senator Wendy Davis received national attention last year when she filibustered new abortion legislation in Texas for 11 hours. She's now running for governor of Texas, and she's in the national news again.
This time it's for her role as a mother during her political career. Critics have accused her of lying about her biography and abandoning her children while she pursued a law degree at Harvard. Davis and her kids have responded, calling the remarks inappropriate and inaccurate.
From Nancy Pelosi to Sarah Palin, women are often asked different questions and evaluated differently from men during their political campaigns. Today, we'll look at what role motherhood plays in political careers.
We'll also be taking your calls throughout the half hour. Do you think that women are treated fairly when they run for political office? Do you think mothers or women in general bring a different perspective to the legislative process? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Former Wisconsin Lieutenant Lieutenant Governor Barbara Lawton will join us in a few minutes. First, Michelle Swerz joins us. She's professor of American government at Georgetown University. She's written extensively about women in politics. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What are some of the unique challenges, before we get to motherhood, I guess, that women face when they run for political office?
Well, when women run for political office, because women are so underrepresented, they're still quite unique. And when they're running for office, they face this double bind where they need to prove that they are both tough and able to be strong leaders, but also they still have the feminine qualities that people associate with women regarding compassion and caring about particular kinds of issues related to social welfare and children and things like that.
Getting to motherhood now. With Wendy Davis, some of the questions are about the timeline she presented and some factual challenges to that, but also about how she balanced her political ambition, her law career, with child raising. When Sarah Palin was announced as a vice presidential candidate, there was talk of how can she do that and raise five children at a time. Do men ever face those questions about balancing that ambition and fatherhood?
Not as much. People still associate mothers as the primary caregivers of children. So when Rick Santorum was running for the presidential nomination, and he has quite a large family, no one was asking who was taking care of all of his children. It was just assumed that his wife is, and there's nothing to ask about. But when women run for office and they have young children, people are more interested and they're more likely to question who's taking care of the kids and want to know more of those details.
So why? Why do we in the media ask these questions differently? What would it take would it be a good idea to change that mindset?
Well, the public is ambivalent. The public wants women to have opportunities in the workforce and supports the idea of women in higher public office. You know, Gallup polls say almost everyone supports electing a woman president. But the public also worries about the fate of young children and associates that with women taking care of young children. And so they get more concerned about what happens to the kids when you have a woman running for office, and that's what's happening here.
A candidate in this position where her biography is being questioned, where that motherhood versus political ambition question is being debated, how can that candidate respond?
Well, for Wendy Davis, she's focusing on her life story because it's an inspiring life story and because she's a Democrat running in Texas. So she can't run on the Democratic Party because that's not a very popular party in Texas. They're more Republican. So she's using her character. So here she's trying to use her character and talk about her life story to get people to vote for her. And so therefore the other side is trying to attack her character by poking holes in her story and criticizing certain aspects of her life.
We've got a caller on this now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi, you're on the air.
I agree that it's very unfair for women that they have to answer questions that male candidates do not. However, women sometimes run, as your guest just commented, on their history. If they're going to run on their history, they have to be responsible for their history, just as sometimes legislatures have to run on their records, whether they're men or women, and then answer for that. Thank you.
Charlie, thanks for the call. So if someone like Wendy Davis uses her background as a mom, as one of her cases for being elected, is it fair to evaluate that?
Well, it's certainly fair if somebody's running, you know, on a certain record. It's certainly fair to question certain things. I think here, what's being complained about is that she's getting extra criticism and extra scrutiny, and maybe there's extra judgment based on her life choices. So, for example, you know, if a man went to law school and his children were staying at home with the mother, people wouldn't be questioning as much as in her case where the mother goes to law school and the children are left home with the father. So maybe in that sense there's some unfairness. But certainly since she's presented herself and her life story, you know, that's going to become fodder for the media and her political opposition to attack.
We're talking about women in politics and parenting in politics and whether there's a double standard between somebody with a political career, a man with children, a woman with children. Does the public view them differently? Does the media view them differently? I want to hear your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. I've heard an argument sometimes that we need more moms in particular in elected office, in Congress, in legislatures, in executive office. Is there a unique perspective that they bring that brings value to the rest of us?
Yes, certainly in the research that I've done on women in Congress and the House and Senate, you find across both parties that women in Congress do tend to focus more on prioritize issues related to women, related to children, related to families. And they do bring their perspective, as everyone does, of their life experience. So if you have someone who's been a mother, she brings that perspective to the table. And having a diverse set of perspectives is very helpful. So right now you have in Congress Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, and Rosa DeLauro, who is a House member from Connecticut, both have introduced bills related to family leave, and they're both spending a lot of time on that issue. Now, there are many men who support that issue, but they're the ones who are spending their political capital trying to move that forward in a political climate right now that's really not very friendly towards it.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jenny joins us now in Milwaukee. Jenny, hi.
I just wanted to say that I think a lot of this problem also stems from other women in the workforce, or other women even on their own political side that would criticize choices that women make to sacrifice for their career. And I think it's valid to say that women do have to sacrifice more often than men do in a family situation. But I'd like to also contribute that that's a really valid sacrifice and that having women's voices in our political sphere is the only way that it'll change.
Jenny, thanks a lot for the call. So the first point she was making there, I think that it's not necessarily a partisan cudgel, but even women within the same party might be judging candidates like a Wendy Davis or a Sarah Palin for their decisions.
Well, I think that maybe they would have some opinions, but certainly to her point about women having to make sacrifices, if you look at the average age of women in politics, women are usually older. And more of them run after their families are grown. More of them are single when you compare them to men. So she is correct to say that clearly women are making certain sacrifices when they pursue a political career. And in legislatures, usually power comes from seniority, so it's not helpful to women when they run later in life. And that's why there are a lot of organizations now that are focused on trying to elect younger women and encourage more young women and more mothers to run for office to get women's voices in there at an earlier age.
So if the norm is for women to wait until their children are grown and moved away, essentially that gives men a 20-year head start to climb the political ladder.
I don't think that the averages are that much different.
Okay, I exaggerated.
But there is a difference, and there is more emphasis now, and you do see more younger women in politics, and even just the State of the Union address, Republicans particularly chose Kathy McMorris Rodgers because she's the only woman to ever have had all three of her children while she is a sitting member of Congress.
Hmm. And what about a woman who hasn't had children? Is there a judgment there in the public or the media when she runs for office?
Certainly there is. So people will always scrutinize. And so if someone doesn't have children and you associate women with having children and with being mothers, then people will question, well, why didn't she get married? Why is she single? And sometimes people will make that extra leap and start questioning, if it's a particularly rough campaign, whether she's a lesbian or not.
Do you see public attitudes and media attitudes changing, even if slowly, over time?
I think public attitudes are certainly changing. Over time, there is much more support for women in the workforce, for women who have young children being in the workforce. In terms of the media, it's a little bit of a murky picture. Because we have more 24-hour news and cable channels and the internet, well, then you see more focus in those locales of these more salacious type stories, because there isn't 24 hours of news. Sometimes you have to make it, and you know, viewers respond to controversy. And these are controversies that are very easy for people to understand and to relate to and to get interested in. So the cable and the internet can sometimes contribute to sort of raising the temperature of these debates.
Looking at the job of running for office and maybe having to go to your state capital or the national capital, it seems like that would be really hard as a parent to juggle the role of parent, father or mother, and the political side. How big a juggling act is that for our legislators?
Certainly it is a juggling act, and you'll probably find more women in office when the state capital is closer to where they live. In terms of women in Congress, you know, it's a difficult schedule in Congress. They can hold votes at any time of the day or night. So in that way, it's difficult. But in other ways, they have more control over their schedule than, let's say, the janitors who are cleaning the Capitol building, in that they can decide, I'm going to have a meeting now or I'm not going to have a meeting now. So Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, she will often talk about the fact that she has time to call her kids and discuss their homework every night that she sets aside, and that she was a troop leader of her daughter's Brownie troop and attends all the soccer games and things like that. So she can carve out areas of her schedule to make sure that she gets time with her children. But for anybody who has a demanding job, it's always going to be difficult to balance that with work and family.
We're speaking with Michelle Swerz, professor of American government at Georgetown University, talking about motherhood in political campaigns and politics.
Coming up, we'll be joined by former Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Barbara Lawton to hear her perspective on the issue.
And we want to hear what you think, your questions, your thoughts, your observations, or experiences. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234.
We're back with a discussion about how mothers are treated in politics. Texas gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis has been criticized lately for not focusing on her children while she pursued her career, according to critics.
Georgetown University professor Michelle Swerz stays with us. Now we're joined also by Barbara Lawton, former lieutenant governor of Wisconsin in the Jim Doyle administration. She's now the CEO of Americans for Campaign Reform. You can also join the conversation by calling us at 800-642-1234. Barbara Lawton, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what was your reaction when you saw this latest round of coverage of a mom in politics, in this case, Wendy Davis, down in Texas?
Oh, it was a deep sigh that you hear all too often from women of a certain age who have seen this over and over. And it reminded me, my children were grown when I took office, but it reminded me when I started work on a graduate degree toward a PhD, and I commuted from Green Bay to Madison. And the criticism, of even though my children were well tended to and had rides to basketball practice and all of that, there was criticism of not tending properly to your children and focusing on them. Women pay such a price for our reproductive role in society with lesser wages and criticism if we aren't taking care of everyone properly, but high expectations and an essential need for our contribution to an economy.
What do you think, now that you're not directly involved in running for and serving in office, how can a woman respond when she gets this kind of criticism?
Well, I think that she must respond, and she must respond quickly. When I was in office, we were told as women, don't say a word. It'll sound like you're whining. Just let it go. You know, toughen up. And what we have discovered, a very smart study was done a couple years ago it was called Name It, Change It, that if a woman suffered a gender-based assault like that kind of public criticism, a woman in office, that if she didn't answer it right away and call it that, and call it a gender-based assault, her support, now this was looking specifically at candidates for office in the middle of their campaign, her support would drop significantly. If she let it go a few more days, her support could drop by as much as half and not be recuperable. So the old received wisdom that a woman shouldn't respond to gender-based attacks was proven wrong. So I hope and I think that that not only did Wendy Davis try to address it directly, but her children did on her behalf.
Michelle Swerz, bring you in on this. Is that an attitude that is changing and advice that's changing for women candidates? Tackle that head on, try to name it and change it, as Barbara Lawton just said?
Yes, and I think it's a function of the modern campaign. The news cycle is very fast, and stories just spiral out of control. So I think today's candidates will always try and hit these things head on because they know it's going to blow up into a big story. But in addition to that, I mean, there's just been a change in how women candidates run in terms of whether they appear with their family and things like this. And I'm sure Lieutenant Governor Lawton can speak more directly to this, but in the past, women would always appear in commercials with professional clothes. They wouldn't appear with their families because they wanted people to focus on them and their strong leadership and not think about them as mothers. Now you see more female candidates willing to bring in their family, willing to appear with their children in advertising and things like that.
Did I hear you chuckle, Barbara Lawton? How did you tackle that?
I was chuckling at for a variety of reasons. But she's right. I mean, think of the Republican formal response to the State of the Union address last week. There was almost no substance in it, and it was all about a congresswoman's family and how she relates to her family from Congress. But what made me chuckle when she was talking about the way that we had to appear in these commercials without our families, in red, thank you, so that people would know that you were powerful. Women, unfortunately, were coached to become a cliche of themselves. And one of the things is that Name It, Change It study and why it's so important to respond to those gender-based attacks is there is no way to change the culture without doing it. And in fact, when I spoke after that study came out to a group of women, corporate women executives, I said to them, what makes you think that this is so neatly contained in the political realm, when in fact there's so few women, such a small percentage in C-suite offices and at the head of corporations or partners in law firms? It is because there are habits of discrimination in the political realm and in the private sector that we have to change. It doesn't mean that they're all intentional, but they're real.
And Barbara Lawton, you tried to create a caucus, I gather, for women while you were in the state legislature. How'd that go?
Well, I wasn't in the legislature, but there was no women's legislative caucus, and most states had one or had had one. And so I invited all of the women in both parties in both houses to a gathering in my office, and the first time I had maybe 7 Democrats and 3 Republicans. And the second time, it was closer to a total of 20 and more even numbers. And they were very excited, really excited about the possibility or how we could create a shared agenda and demonstrate leadership where there weren't women really in leadership at that point, but to demonstrate the leadership in finding common ground and being a more productive legislature than the polarized politics that we see today. Well, what happened was the next time when they wanted to get together, and they counted on me convening it, which was interesting, that it somehow wasn't going to keep going from within the legislature, but if I did it from without, that was fine, and wanted to get together outside the Capitol and have dinner. So I sent out an invitation, and in a little while, one of the Republican women wrote back to me, and she said, the Speaker of the Assembly has declared that we have to meet at exactly the time we were going to have dinner. I can't imagine what would be on the agenda. We'll be done inside an hour. Can we bump up the time by an hour? Sure. So I resent the invitation. He changed the time of the meeting. And this went on 3 times. And finally, we just went ahead and had dinner, and the Republican women didn't come. And in fact, in that meeting led by the speaker, they were threatened with their committee chairmanship positions if they were to continue to be engaged in the caucus.
I want to bring a couple more of our callers in on this. I think before we're done, we've got Chris on the line in Sun Prairie. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to mention, I did bristle at some gender bias in the presidential campaign last time when Hillary was asked a myriad of questions that no one would ever think of asking Mr. Obama. And not only that, but the way she was treated, when she talked about how it emotionally affected her was gender bias, and it was finally called out in the media, and I had been watching that happen over and over and over since the 70s, since Phyllis Schlafly, was railed against, and nobody from the national organization of women was ever questioned in their personal lives. It happens over and over again. Conservative women, I think, are discriminated against in the media. Margaret Farrell was peppered by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with questions that Annie Baldwin was never asked by any of the state papers.
Thanks for the call, Chris. I want to get a response from Michelle Swerz on that one. Margaret Farrell, by the way, former state senator, former lieutenant governor herself, frequent guest on Joy Cardine's morning show here on the Ideas Network. Do conservative women face the brunt of this as much as or more than, say, liberal counterparts?
I think conservative women and liberal women both will get questions about things like motherhood. Maybe what the caller is concerned about is that sometimes people think conservative women get more scrutiny because people expect women to be Democrats, because women in office currently are much more likely to be Democrats. But if you expect women to be Democrats, then maybe you would criticize conservative women more. There's certainly stereotypes that would say that the liberal women are stereotyped as being sort of too strong. I don't want to use nasty words on the radio, and that the conservative women are more criticized stereotypically as being too much like beauty pageant queens and airheads and dumb and things like this that you would hear. So certainly there are some differences in the stereotypes that sometimes apply.
And Barbara Lawton, you were a Democratic lieutenant governor, but do you see this as a bipartisan problem for women in politics?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As I said, we still have we have too few women in office, and they haven't got enough, there isn't parity, and there aren't enough voices for strength in determining public policy and enough history of women providing leadership. And that's a very serious problem. But these are habits of discrimination that really don't know any partisan lines. I mean, there's the ironic thing that with Wendy, the criticism that has landed on Wendy Davis's head, as I recall, some of it came from Sarah Palin, who also suffered gender-based attacks, but whose daughter has been critical of Wendy Davis, for sure. Good heavens, we all have to stop this and look at the important contribution that women have to make, especially in elected office, and find a way to make sure that they can make that contribution at the highest level and that we have more of them.
We'll leave it there. Barbara Lawton, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Michelle Swerz, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Barbara Lawton, former Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin, and Michelle Swerz, Professor of American Government at Georgetown University, talking about criticism of a Texas candidate for how she shared up her role as mother and as candidate.
A new project out of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee recently caught our attention, and it's trying to turn the tables on the man behind the world's most influential social network, Facebook, which turned 10 years old this week.
The project is called The Zuckerberg Files. It's a digital archive of all the public statements made by Facebook's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, information that hasn't always been easy to find otherwise.
Here to tell us more about the project and why he thinks it's needed is one of its creators, Michael Zimmer. He's the director of the Center for Information Policy and Research at UW-Milwaukee and an assistant professor of information studies. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So why do you think we need an archive for all of Mark Zuckerberg's public statements?
Well, one of the things that has really interested me is the way that Facebook and Zuckerberg in particular talk about things like users and privacy and our information. And I was really interested to see if this has changed over time. What kind of language does he use? How does it respond to questions or controversies about our privacy? And so I started doing research on that and started compiling like copies of his speeches and realized this is actually could be a really useful public service to put all this together for anybody who wants to do this kind of research could have access to.
Well, I imagine that how he feels about privacy has evolved over the years. If, you know, we believe the movie The Social Network sort of seemed like a dating tool in the beginning. I can't imagine that privacy was utmost on his mind at that moment, but it's certainly become more front and center now. Do you have a sense of how his feelings have changed over time?
Yeah, it goes back and forth, and oftentimes, you know, it's a reaction to how the public responds to certain features or certain things that they've done with the platform. And I think at first his general philosophy was we need to share everything, and we'll meet girls or we'll meet people, we'll be more friendly if we share things. And then every once in a while they change a feature where suddenly, you know, you and I as users suddenly realize that something's a little different. I have a little bit less control or all of a sudden something that I thought was private is a little bit more public. So we react to that. But overall, Facebook has been making it a little bit harder for you to control your privacy. And he does talk a little bit differently about it. He tends to talk a lot about control and giving, as long as users have control, then we're going to have some privacy. And as a scholar, it's not always quite that simple. And it's something that I'm hoping by making, you know, this archive available that we can start studying this a little bit more and perhaps even convince him that just having control isn't quite good enough always.
Does he talk directly about privacy? Did you find that? Or is it something that he talks around?
He tends to talk around it. That's a good point. I think earlier on, he engaged it a little bit more. And then I think slowly as the company got larger, you know, things got a little bit more professional. I think his rhetoric and his language changed a little bit, where they talk more about transparency or openness. And he, you know, if there's an issue about privacy, maybe a different engineer or somebody else will talk about something about the platform, and he's trying to talk at a little bit of a higher level.
Now, you've got these archives up there. There are transcriptions, there is metadata, there's public statements. What struck you the most from this collection of Zuckerberg files?
Well, he certainly has become a better speaker, and I think it's, you know, it's probably no secret. You know, he's just a computer programmer. He was a kid that dropped out of college, and all of a sudden he was in the spotlight. He was never really that comfortable with speaking, and there are lots of missteps and gaffes, and over time he's gotten better and more comfortable and a little bit more polished. And I think his worldview has changed a little bit. You know, he first started talking about Facebook just as a directory, just as a way to find people and meet people. And over time, that has evolved into Facebook being a platform for change, a platform that can change the whole planet and help us, you know, understand each other better and actually be some social good. So it was interesting to see that kind of change in his thinking.
What sort of reception have you gotten so far for this?
Well, it's been really positive. I was quite surprised and excited when we first launched it. We had just a flood of attention and quite a number of researchers. We've had almost 100 researchers who now have access to the archives. You know, a few people think, you know, that, you know, I'm just trying to sort of stick one to Zuckerberg by making his comments, you know, more public. But, you know, that's not my point. I'm just trying to make sure we can try to understand him and his relationship to the company. So far, he hasn't, you know, responded to me directly. But the reaction has been good. I'm really enthusiastic about keeping the archive going.
And what kind of reaction have you gotten from people other than Zuckerberg, people who might be using the Zuckerberg files to check in on what he's saying?
Well, they're finding it useful, and I've seen people with a variety of different interests. You know, some have an interest like me in terms of, you know, privacy or ethics or those kind of issues with the platform. Others want to study him as an entrepreneur. Some want to be able to study his language as a leader or what it means to run a company like this and how has he changed and matured and what can we learn from his style. At least, you know, he's one of the youngest billionaires in the world, and maybe there is something we can learn from that. So it's been, you know, we're seeing all different kinds of reactions.
So what was it like putting this together? Did it sort of change your mind about why privacy concerns are something that deserve a cultural conversation at this point in history?
Well, it certainly has affected me in terms of watching him grow. You know, I've been following Facebook almost since it started, and really have been a pretty vocal critic in terms of its privacy, you know, practices. But being able to sort of see him and listen to him and see him in different situations, you do come to appreciate, you know, the position he must be in just in general. At the same time, you know, I know my students who've been working on this and transcribing things, we're getting kind of sick of listening to him. He sounds awfully the same. He answers questions the same way. He has the same little, you know, sayings and idioms, and that gets a little annoying after time.
I hear you guys have some impressions. Do you have one?
I don't. I wouldn't dare try one, but a couple of my students do. Yeah.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it today.
Thanks, Veronica. I appreciate the time.
We've been speaking to Michael Zimmer, director of the Center for Information Policy Research at UW-Milwaukee and an assistant professor of information studies.